Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I have a guest on the line. In fact, she's very anxious. She's ready to go. She's got good stuff to talk to us about. And we were ready to rock and roll. And I was like, hold on, Daisy Maxey. And she's back. And she is a special writer at the Wall Street Journal. She has done a lot of wonderful work over her 24 years of experience in newswire, newspaper, and news media industries. She works for Dow Jones since 2006, writes columns on various types of investments, instruments, different types of mutual funds, annuities, financial advisors, and their firms. And she gets into some pretty complicated stuff. And I tell you, I'm impressed. Daisy, the work you've done, it really is remarkable. She holds a Bachelor's of Arts degree and a Master's of Science degree. So she is well-stocked, Graduate School of Journalism. I mean, just gobs of experience, and I'm excited to have her back. And if she's back, you know she's a good guest. So there she is. Daisy, welcome.
Well, oh, thanks so much for that wonderful intro.
Well, it's all true. In fact, anytime you want me to introduce you, call me. I'll do it.
Okay. Nice to talk with you again.
Yes, thank you much. And I'm a little bit overflowing here because I like to read what other people are, you know, thinking, and kind of this whole, you know, investment world. It's got so many little pieces and parts to it. It's like a diamond, you know, and all these different facets. And so you wrote a couple of recent articles. I'm like, wow, this is interesting. So let's share a little bit with the listeners. And some of the stuff is a little bit detailed, but I think it's fascinating, and it just shows people, as we talk through it, Daisy, just how some of this stuff is really, it's involved, and it takes a little bit of time, but it's definitely worth understanding. So let's just dive in if we can. You wrote a couple. The one I was really curious about was advisors using this terminology or this way of a measurement called active share about how mutual funds and other funds are managed. And so I wanted to dig into a little bit about it because I find it a very interesting ongoing discussion among investment professionals and the funds and how these folks are doing what they're doing. So if you'll give us a little bit of background, then we can kind of dig into it a little bit.
Okay. Well, the first thing I'd say about this active share, which is just generally a measure of how your fund's holdings, a mutual fund's holdings differ from its index, from a passive index that has a group of similar holdings in a certain area, say large cap stocks. And how does this fund manager's holdings differ? You try to measure that. That's what active share tries to do, to show an advisor or an institutional investor, is your fund manager really doing something different, or is he just tracking along with everyone else? That was the idea. And it's something, too, that if listeners are hearing this and concerned about it, it's not used that much by individual investors right now. And I don't think it's something they really have to be concerned about other than to maybe get a general understanding, as hopefully we'll give them today, of this, so that if they hear it from an advisor or someone, they can know what is being discussed. It's been around for a while, but it became very popular, started to be popular in 2009 when a couple of Yale colleagues at the finance professor at the Yale School of Management, there was Martin Kramer's and Ante Pettegisto. They were both colleagues at the Yale School of Management, and they wrote this paper in 2009 kind of laying out the idea of active management. And their idea was that they wanted to identify active managers who were really closet indexers, what we call a closet indexer, somebody who just tracks along with a passive index and doesn't do anything different. So they computed the active share for more than 2,000 U.S. equity mutual funds from 1980 to 2003. And, you know, what they came up with, it was just a percentage which would show how the fund differed from the index in terms of its holdings.
Okay.
And those with the lowest active share, about 60% or lower, were generally underperforming their benchmarks. And those with the higher active shares were doing better, about, say, 80% or higher active share were doing better. And, you know, their idea was that it was a quick and dirty way, as they said, to show if your fund manager is doing something different. So for example, if a fund had an active share of zero, that means that it holds exactly the same holdings as its benchmark,
like a
U.S. stock fund. If you compare it to the S&P 500, if it's exactly the same, it would have a 0% active share. If it was completely different, it would have 100% active share.
Okay, so the idea is that you're looking for, you know, with this kind of quick and dirty analysis, you're looking to see just how much of the fund's actual holdings match up to the actual index or benchmark that is the best one to track them by.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And because, you know, the intuitive thought is that the higher the percentage, you would think it would be more like it, but it's actually inverted. So a zero is your... So it's really almost like the degree to which you divert or diverge from your benchmark. So 100 means you're completely off. It's almost like 180 degrees direction the other way.
Right. And for those who don't understand benchmark, you know, it just means that's the passive group, the group who's just buying kind of a broad base of, say, large cap equity stocks. If your manager isn't diverging from that at all, he's at a 0%. If he's at 100%, he's doing a lot of different unique things.
Okay. So now the next question that's a natural question, I guess, to ask is, different isn't necessarily better. In other words, if we're looking for, you know, the fund manager to be not just a closet indexer where he's just really, you know, instead of saying, hey, I'm an index fund, or hey, we've got this index fund to track this, the S&P 500, you know, they're just kind of chugging along and getting this performance that potentially can just track the market very closely. So it kind of just is shining a light on who's in the closet. I mean, it's just really saying, who are you, who's, that's the whole purpose of this, is to kind of really expose that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a 100 score or a 0 score on this measure of active share really is good or bad, is it?
Well, that's exactly right. And one of the reasons I wrote about it is because more financial advisors are using it. The financial advisory business has become a lot more competitive. And in one way that they can win clients is to say, look, we have these funds that differ from their passive benchmarks. These managers are really doing something different. They have this active share. So it's beginning to be used by them, and some people fear that some advisors are looking at active share and saying, oh, this manager is doing something very different, he must be great. And as you said, that's not something you should, you know, a conclusion you should come to. Most of the people I spoke to, in fact, believe that active share is a great thing to look at, but it's one part of the process.
Yeah.
You could have someone who has a different active share, a very high active share. They're doing something very different, but it's all wrong. What they're doing is going into all the wrong things.
Right.
So don't assume just because you do see a manager whose holdings differ greatly from a passive benchmark that this is a great manager. It's just one part of the process to look at.
That's good, Daisy. Yeah, it's just one piece. I mean, but I get the sense of what they're after, because, you know, if I'm looking at building a portfolio and we manage money for a fee, as you know, Daisy, so that's a lot of what we do. And if I'm looking to build a portfolio and I follow this kind of thought process to, you know, its natural conclusion, then if I'm gonna be getting, you know, an index or passive portion, then let me just be a purist about it and go ahead and have my ETFs or whatever I'm going to do for that, the more passive part of the portfolio. And then when I'm picking quote-unquote funds, I need to be looking, even though I may be buying them for large, medium, small cap, whatever my benchmarks are, or domestic versus foreign, whatever, that I'm actually getting funds that are going to be, you know, truly there's active risk there. In other words, the manager will, you know, live or die by their alpha that they provide.
Right. I mean, as you know, you're paying for this active management.
Exactly.
And you're paying a lot more you're paying somewhat more at least, and often a lot more than you would pay for just a plain index fund.
Right, right.
For someone who's just passively tracking an index as opposed to a manager who's doing their legwork, who's doing the due diligence, you're paying for that. And you don't want to be paying for that if he's not doing anything different. And that's part of what started this process. I did talk to a Brian Goodstead. He's a co-founder of Paragon Capital Management in Denver. And he says he won't buy a fund unless it has a high active share. He says, you know, if you want to beat the market, it's a necessity. If you're just tracking the index, you can't beat the market. But he did say, you know, just because a fund has a high active share doesn't mean it will outperform. And he uses it only as a starting point in evaluating a fund.
Well, and I imagine that the mutual fund companies have something to say about this.
Oh, indeed they do. Several of the fund companies, I talked to Russ Kinnell, and he's the director of manager research at Morningstar, and he says that some of the fund companies that tend to have lower active shares, such as American funds and Fidelity Investments, have provided good research to counter the argument that active share can predict performance. American funds has looked at this, and they say their research shows that a fund's fees and whether the manager of the fund owns shares in the fund are more important factors to consider mm-hmm. when selecting funds. And they made the point that, you know, an active share doesn't show whether the fund's holdings deviate from its benchmark in a positive way. They have funds, they say, again, this is American funds, they have funds mm-hmm. with higher and lower active share that have produced better than index results.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you what, it's always your perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, and Fidelity has also jumped on the bandwagon on this. They say they've studied data on more than 2,000 funds, and that's from December of 97 to March of 13. And, you know, they divided that data into large and small cap subsets. And their research, they say, called into question this correlation of active share and excess return, at least for large cap funds.
Yeah, it's interesting. All these little kind of twists and turns and new ways of looking at it. And, you know, just, you know, we've got, you know, smart beta. We've got, you know, the lightly leveraged ETFs. I mean, it's like, you know, it's always this. New, different, new, different, new, different, new, different.
That's right, and often it's the same.
Yeah, all right.
But, you know, one of the things I think for the average investor to know about active share is it does just try to show the difference between the fund's holdings and a passive manager. So is your active manager really doing something for the money that he or she's being paid? But don't take it to mean that this fund is going to outperform or underperform based on its active share metric. Just one thing to look at.
It's just one more measurement in looking at the portfolio. And if nothing else, though, Daisy, you could certainly use it at a cocktail party.
Well, no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. Daisy Maxey, ladies and gentlemen, special writer at the Wall Street Journal. And we are very glad to have her back. We've got a few more things we want to get into with Daisy. So stay right there. We'll be right back.
Does getting financial advice seem like a game of cat and mouse? Maybe it's time to hire a fiduciary, a financial professional who puts the needs of his clients ahead of his own. A fiduciary also means an advisor should recommend products and services he believes will best serve his clients' needs, not what an insurance company or investment company tells him he has to sell. Next time you're talking to an advisor, ask him, "Are you a fiduciary? Yes or no?" If the advisor doesn't know, then the answer's probably no. This public service announcement is brought to you by Holland Financial, who wants to help you to plan stronger. For more information, call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com.
And we are back with Daisy Maxey, and she is a Wall Street Journal special writer, and you can get a glimmer and glimpse of Daisy's work over at the Wall Street Journal, WSJ.com. Read the articles and be a fan like me and watch what she's writing. And we'll, of course, always want to bring her back when we see things that are interesting and I can work with her schedule. Daisy, I wanted to get to another one that really was interesting article, and I think this one's going to become a very big topic as we go into potentially the next interest rate cycle. And I stress the potential part of that because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about when interest rates will go up. And you wrote the article April 23rd, municipal bond funds get flexible. So the bond funds are getting ready for what they know and what they've already seen to be a potential exodus of investor dollars for fear of interest rate increases causing, to put it technically, a bond devaluation risk for the investor. And they know they need to get more flexible. So you're seeing them shift and recalibrate and kind of position themselves for this, especially, which I found very interesting, especially in the muni bond. Why are you seeing, I mean, I can understand if there was going to be a lot of preparing and kind of recalibration with more of the taxable and the corporate bond, but why muni bonds? That kind of struck me as interesting.
Well, the short answer is that on the taxable side, this has already happened. There are a lot of these unconstrained bond funds already. Mm-hmm. And now that's a big part of the reason the muni area is becoming more flexible. At least six of them have been launched or retooled to give managers in the muni area to give managers more flexibility to either manage duration or buy below investment grade bonds. Bond funds typically mimic the holdings of market averages or indexes like the Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. But some years ago, with all this concern about interest rates on the taxable side, a lot of funds started to become more flexible. And there are different ways to do that. You know, they can either bet on the direction of interest rates by getting into long-term bonds and hoping that if interest rates stay stable or fall, they can make money. They can buy riskier bonds. Or if the economy improves, those riskier bonds may do better. Or they can buy something that's not even in the benchmark, something other than bonds. Some of these unconstrained bonds in the taxable area are buying, betting on currencies, even investing in bank loans or stocks in some cases, mm-hmm. real estate. So they're really branching out. And they've had, a mixed performance. But the folks in the muni area are seeing this. And with the concerns, as you mentioned, over rising rates and the evolving muni market landscape, which is permitting them to have a little bit more more opportunity for fund managers to kind of distinguish themselves in this area. And then they look at the taxable side, which has had a tremendous success at gathering assets in these unconstrained funds. The unconstrained bond funds on the taxable side took in $79 billion in new money in 2013 and 2014. So that all attracted the folks on the municipal side.
Okay, so it's a little bit of like the baby boomers and the echo baby boomers, you know, that next ripple in the cycle that they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we better get prepared. Because, and now the thing that struck me is very interesting when I read your article, Daisy, was that some of the things that, as you describe, what they're doing to become more flexible and, you know, the ability to invest in shorter duration, you know, instead of being maybe a 3 to 10 year, maybe you're 0 to 15 or something like that, where it's a broader range of duration, how long those bonds work out to be. That's kind of that makes sense to me. But what was really curious was some of this movement that you had identified, that they were also changing the mix of what they hold, including how risky these bonds are. And I think that the thing that's remarkable about that is that when people think, generally speaking, very generally speaking, but they think about muni bonds, they do think of more safety. So if we're going to introduce a broader range of risk options, I guess, that may make it a little bit more of an interesting play out with how these bonds are going to work for people.
Well, there's no doubt, and that's one of the concerns, is that if you're getting involved with any of these funds on the taxable side or the muni side, you should realize that you may be taking on more risk, and you had better look carefully at what your fund is doing. I talked to Elizabeth Fuz, an analyst at Morningstar, and she said, you know, that she recommends investors approach any of these funds with caution. Most of them are new. They generally carry, you know, the same risk as these flexible bond funds on the taxable side,
right.
And some that are particular to the muni market.
Right.
She said these muni bond funds fish from a far narrower universe than
yeah,
the taxable
exactly.
counterparts, and that can make it difficult for them to make these quick and cheap changes to credit and interest rate exposure. It could cost the fund manager to do that, for example. It might not be something they can do quickly if they want to shift. And while the fund might have a wide latitude to shift its investments, sometimes if a manager makes a bad call, that can just mean amplified losses.
Yeah, and if you know, if your pool of investments is much smaller and the temperature drops, your little lake might freeze up pretty quickly and you might not have a lot of choices. Yeah, you might have the latitude, but you may not have the ability. And some of these investments that they're getting into with credit default swaps and baskets and, you know, different exposure to different types of securities that they may hold, I think that the real takeaway is that the investor, if they are going to have a bond, a mutual fund based portfolio that's built with muni bonds, that, you know, they do need to take a little more time and look a little closer than just that plain vanilla muni bond they might have had before.
Yes. You know, one of the concerns is they're investing in junk bonds, and it can be very difficult to find the right high-yield investment in the Muni area. Morningstar says that junk bonds represent just a small portion of the Muni market, and they can trade infrequently. In 2008, the taxable funds that were tracked by Morningstar, I think they lost about 16.8% on average, while the Barclays Ag, the broad bond index, gained about 5%. Now, the next year they did quite a bit better than the Barclays Ag. I think they more than tripled the return as the bonds recovered. But that's something to keep in mind.
Oh yeah, that's a significant amount of volatility. Again, what's the purpose of the muni bond portion of the portfolio to begin with? Let's back up and say, what are we really trying to accomplish? Are we trying to have a more of an equity type of behavior for that part of the portfolio, or is this supposed to be part of a stabilizing portion of the portfolio?
Well, yeah, and that's, most people do consider it more of they look for it at least to be more of a stabilizing part. And I have to say, though, investors have so far been pouring some money into these BlackRock Strategic Municipal Opportunities Fund, one of these municipal, more flexible funds. It took in about more than $2.4 billion since it was modified in January of last year through March, the end of March this year, to you make it more flexible. So people have been putting money in, and some of the advisors I spoke to are using them. They're being a little more cautious, you know, using these funds as just a portion.
Yeah, they're controlling how much goes into that fund and giving the fund manager greater latitude.
Right, and that could be one way for investors to look at it, you know, just to go cautiously with them.
Well, the question will be, is that they're going out of the frying pan and onto the plate, or out of the frying pan and into the fire?
Right.
We want a nice meal, not to be in the embers. So let's go grab another quick break. Enjoying our conversation with Daisy Maxey. You can see why she's back. Quick break, and we'll be right back.
Where can you find more spin than in politics? If you said financial services, you'd be correct. Just ask a stockbroker or insurance agent how you should invest your money, and what do you think they would say? Unfortunately, if an advisor is limited in what he can offer, that advisor is often understandably biased. You need to ask questions like what products and services they can and cannot offer. Ask about their licensing and credentials. Remain skeptical. This PSA has been brought to you by Holland Financial, who wants to help you to plan stronger. For more information, call 671-PLAN or visit planstronger.com. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
And we're back. Daisy Maxey's a returning guest. Glad to have her on. And Wall Street Journal. You'll find a lot of her great writings there. Well done research and insightful analysis, I will add. WSJ.com. is where you can find Daisy's work. And, you know, I wanted to go maybe a little bit more to 50,000 or even 100,000 feet on some of this, Daisy. And, you know, from your perspective, as you're researching your various articles, and I know there's a whole bunch we could get into, and we only have so much time. But when you look at the landscape, and I try to pay attention because, you know, that's part of my job, how this is all evolving. And we talked before about how there's, you know, a new twist on the same old thing. But from your perspective, do you see is it a lot of noise, or is there also really some true specialization that's happening where we're just getting more and more specific on how we invest, and there's actual real measures of value, and mutual funds and advisors have to demonstrate value, or there's another competitor to take their place? What are you seeing as kind of a mega trend with all of this?
Well, I do think we're getting more specific exposure.
Okay.
The opportunity for more specific exposure. I think the question is, from that high level you mentioned, for the individual investor, the question is, do you want to take that very specific exposure? Are you qualified? Do you need to hire an advisor? Or do you want to do a broad index fund? Because there's all this temptation out there, and leveraged exchange-traded funds were one example where they came up with 3x leverage, and a lot of investors jumped into that thinking, oh, I can get 3x this index, and they interpreted it in the wrong way and lost a lot of money.
Yeah.
So getting into these very specific specific kinds of exposures without knowing what you're doing is very dangerous.
You know, sure. It reminds me of Vegas, Daisy. I mean, they've got a game for every potential kind of risk or way of gambling your money that you can imagine. I mean, so it's almost like that the market or the manufacturer of these products and investments have said, you know, we'll take a page from Vegas and give you plenty of things that you can choose from.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that you and I didn't mention yet were our fees. One of the things to keep in mind is every time you get into this specialization, you're increasing your fees. Some of these flexible muni funds, for example, have fees of 1.3% versus an index fund where you're going to pay 0.15 basis points. You know, very a big difference in fees. So that's certainly something that often investors don't even pay attention to when they
have no idea. And when I can tell you that when I do an analysis, I do this all the time, Daisy. I do an analysis of somebody's portfolio, and you know, identify any funds. I'm a little more patient, I guess is the word, give a little more latitude. I consider anything over about 1.5% to be quote unquote a high fee when we're looking at the cost of funds and these packaged products. And, you know, I see things where they've got these exotic, specific, special, you know, 3x leverage on a Polish technology fund. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, some sort of very hyper specialized thing, and they're paying 6 or 7, some crazy fee like 5 or 6% a year, you know, to try to get more bang for their buck.
That's right. And one of the things we've seen in the ETF world is extreme specialization in some of these ETFs. And some of it has worked, and a lot of them have been closed just because they didn't do well. There's lack of interest. So they really went a little wild in some cases. And investors can get caught up in this. I think the ETFs, the specialized ETFs, are being used very well by a lot of financial advisors, and they do appreciate being able to pinpoint certain sectors of the market, and some advisors can do it very well. But for the individual investor, that's not the easiest thing for them to pay attention to.
Well put, Daisy. Daisy Maxey, special writer at Wall Street Journal, WSJ.com. Thank you so much, Daisy. We'll be sure to have you back.
Thank you.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.